You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. If you missed any of On the Count, or you know somebody who should have listened to that show, they can go and hear all of it in about 5 or 10 minutes by going to WBAI.org. Coming up now is Street Talk with Bob Law.
There is indeed a new city emerging in New York, a city that is extending an invitation to experience luxury living in multi-million-dollar condos and townhouses, one- and two-bedroom apartments, around $5,000 or more a month. Sleek, high-rise office towers buttressed by restaurants, bars, and sidewalk cafes. It is indeed a new city. But in order for all of this to happen, the real estate had to be made available to the real estate industry and the real estate developers. And to accomplish that task, the City Planning Commissioner, Roger Starr, launched a campaign in the 1970s, 1971, called Planned Shrinkage. It is a scheme sanctioned by the city to temporarily shrink the city's population by removing residents from targeted areas like Harlem, Bronx, Bed-Stuy, Fort Greene, parts of Southeast Queens. We will look closer at what was done to make it harder to exist in those areas, make it difficult to even live in those areas as Planned Shrinkage went into effect. Planned Shrinkage was renamed Gentrification by New York Magazine, so it doesn't sound as sinister as it actually is. And we'll look at how the city may be currently abusing power through policies that are seizing property of black homeowners. This is part two of a major three-part investigative series. Let's look closer at HPD, the city council, and the community. Join me this November 23rd, mid-morning, on From the Street. With me, I'm Bob Law. It's 11:03 on this mid-Saturday morning in the city. I'm Bob Law. This is From the Street with Bob Law. This is the beginning or the middle of a three-part series, investigative series that we're doing. We expect to be back next week for another, get an additional hour to be able to continue to take this issue a little bit further, which is one of the reasons that a radio station like this is really important, is being able to spend the time and bring the information to our community, which is not happening on any other radio station in the city. Nobody would even be inclined to do so. There's media attention. Newsday Magazine has done a major 36-page supplement looking at evidence of unequal treatment in real estate. And as a result of the Newsday story, the State Senate has set Long Island housing hearing. And maybe we can get the same thing happening here. A couple of new books. We talked to the author last week of the book Home Wreckers. There's another book called Race for Profit, How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermine Black Home Ownership. It's beginning to percolate. This whole issue is beginning to develop. And fortunately, we're able to bring it to you through WBAI at 99.5 FM. So it's important that you help us stay here. And it's important that we help with the fundraising and to keep these voices on the air. Right now, we're joined in the conversation by Councilman Robert Carnegie. Councilman Carnegie, are you with me?
Yes, sir, Mr. Law. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Good to have you with me again. You're the one who got me in all of this trouble. This is where it started, in a conversation with Councilman Carnegie, who had raised some questions about this illegal seizure of what appears to be the illegal seizure of property and by the city. Now, a couple of things. We just wanted you to kind of, you know, do an update, since we you and I did a town hall meeting in Brooklyn at First Church on September 10th. And we were curious as to what kind of things have been happening since then. We have seen other media paying attention to this issue. I know that you have taken some steps to protect seniors in your district. Why don't you just to kind of give us an update as to where we are?
So, first of all, I want to thank you for your commitment to a community going back decades, and WBAI for investing and being committed to making sure that people have the information that they need. So like you said, in Long Island, they're doing some things around demonstrating how there's such a disparity in banks and in housing. Same in New York City. But I wanted to talk about the city's potential for culpability in this overall scheme to displace black homeowners from their property and to displace them from the generational wealth that's generated through equity and those kinds of things. So the third-party transfer program, which is how we started this conversation, is in its second or third iteration. And what I'm doing is really dissecting the statute as it was written, which I believe, like I told you before, was written with an attempt to be able to at some point come back and mm-hmm. recapture this market.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, the part of the third-party transfer program that allows for people, that allows for the city to kind of sweep up neighborhoods, whole neighborhoods, when they've identified a property that meets the standard, is one of the things that's absolutely wrong. And we have a bill in that eliminates 1 to 4 families from even being able to participate in the third-party transfer program, because it wasn't designed to displace those homeowners. It was for larger buildings where there had been demonstrated disinvestment over years and people were living in substandard conditions. It was never designed for 1 to 4 families, which are able to be swept up through the statute, which is a small, tiny written part of the statute that allows, if they identify that building, to begin to go in close proximity. And any building that has outstanding tax or water can now become a part of the third-party transfer program. Mm-hmm. We've had a task force was convened to deal with this, which I just kind of went along with just to get it done. But we know what's wrong. We have 15 bills that are ready to go as soon as the task force has its last meeting. We've had 2 meetings already. I got to be honest, the meetings have been productive because people from all over the city have been able to weigh in and hear the voices of actual people who are being displaced through this program.
Mm-hmm. So now this is the third-party transfer program.
Yes, sir. And just a brief a description of the third-party transfer program. It was developed for large buildings where, back in the 70s, 80s, and even early 90s, there was tremendous disinvestment where actual landlords, if you can imagine this, were walking away from their buildings mm-hmm. and leaving them in total disrepair with outstanding violations. And HPD, which is Housing Preservation and Development, would go in and make the repairs at an exponential charge from contractors that they were using and try to pass that cost on to the people who were living in the buildings. But it was never designed. But it was a good program in its premise, because what it sought to do was make sure that people could have a standard of living that was commensurate with dignity. So that was its purpose, which is the reason that I haven't called for a total moratorium on the program, because there's still a segment of society that needs someone to say, hey, this building is not being cared for. The landlord is not, even when he's fined and fees, is not doing what's in the best interest, and transferring that property to a nonprofit net management company has been, for some, a benefit. It's the other small details that people don't know about, that the program allowed for, that the statute has written into it, that have caused so much damage in black and brown communities.
A lot of people are concerned that the HPD or the third-party transfer program is intended to do one thing, but that HPD uses it very differently. And
yes, sir. And that's, and yes. I'm of that same opinion, and that the statute allows them to do it. So they're not even operating out of the out of their own discretion. They're following the letter of the law. And when we met with the commissioner in a 6-hour hearing, she stood on that premise every time we asked the question. Well, the statute allows us to do it. The statute allows us to do it. These are human beings, and whatever the statute allows, you know that it's not correct to displace a $1.5 million home for $3,000 worth of outstanding taxes. You know that as a human being.
And so you have to wonder, why is she saying that?
Absolutely.
You have to wonder, what is the motivation? There's the city council recently voted, as the headline says, to rescue 12 Manhattan buildings from foreclosure and sale. And I know you're aware of that.
Yes, sir.
But how so? How did the city council do that? The city council has the ability to do that?
Through our budget, it allows us to intervene when necessary. And when it's deemed to be so controversial and displaces so many people, we have the latitude as the check and balance to the administration to do a lot of things. It's up to us to, one, understand what our powers are. And for a long time, there hasn't been a solid understanding of what you're able to do as a council person and as a 51-member body. And I think, you know, we're starting to get our legs up under us and understand, doing our research and understand how much power we actually have.
It is good to get this update as how things are moving, how things are developing. And you are getting your legs under you. Some of those folk have been there for years. They ought to know by now. You know, the city
is not a new group. Here's the thing. In all honesty, one of the problems with term limits is right about the time that you really understand what your power is in two terms, in 8 years, you know, is right around the time that you're transitioning out.
Yeah.
So I'm not an advocate for extending term limits, but people need to understand that there is some power and knowledge and information and institutional knowledge with longevity. So I think it's intentional on some people's behalf that you have these two very short 4-year terms. For two reasons it's bad. One is because you never really get a full depth and breadth of what your power is, but also there's no accountability. And when you do stupid things as a body, there's no accountability for that. So by the time what we've done in terms of small business as a body affects this city, most of us will be long gone.
Yeah. So we need some folk in there who hit the ground running, who understand what the power is. And, and that's the reason they ran for city council, because they wanted to get the job done, knowing that they might only have 4 to 8 years to do so.
No, I think there's a lot of people who ran as advocates, and there's nothing wrong with advocacy.
That's right.
But knowing how to legislate, knowing the ins and outs is important. So absolutely. So while we need advocates, we need a solid mix in the council.
Yeah, we need folk who came to get the job done. Robert Carnegie, thank you so much for the update. We're going to stay in touch and let you know how things are progressing with what we're doing here. We will be back again. Maybe listen for the rest of today, hear some of the people that are going to be on, might be helpful as well. And then we'll be back again next week as we kind of sum this all up. But thank you. Thank you for spending this few minutes with us this morning to get it off the ground. Thank you, Councilman Robert Carnegie.
Thank you for your work. You and BAI. I appreciate you.
All right now. We continue to move forward with this conversation. Oh, did we say hello to Alina? We didn't say good morning to Alina yet.
Good morning.
How you doing?
I'm good.
Good, good. And we're going to come back to Alina a little bit later on in this hour. She's got some information to share with us as well. Alina, as you know, is our in-studio intern producer, and we're glad to have you with us.
I'm glad to be here.
We're going to continue to move forward. We're talking to Lisa Abbott. Lisa Abbott is a property owner who is currently caught up in the midst of this deed theft scheme, this illegal seizure of property scheme. And I want her to tell her story. It's getting some national attention. She is going to be on Dr. Oz, I think, next week, as even that show is giving some attention to this issue of the exploitation of property owners, particularly black property owners. This is happening all of the research that we have seen, the books we have read, the articles we have read, the information we have seen, the article in Newsday talks about how this unequal treatment is focused primarily, and in some cases singularly, on black homeowners, black property owners. The Kinega, I believe her name is Kianga Yamata Taylor, the author of Race for Profit, says that some of the primary targets for these schemes are black females, black women. And that is something that we are hearing repeated as well. And so I want you to hear from Lisa Abbott. I want you to hear what it is that she is going through. It sounds like it's fake. It can't be. It is so absurd. This can't be, you know. But this is the kind of thing that people are dealing with, and it's happening right up under the nose of elected officials in this city. Lisa Abbott, welcome.
Yes, hello, good morning, Mr. Law. Thank you so much for allowing me to be on your platform to share my story.
Good. Well, we're really pleased to have you with us, though, and we don't have a lot of time, so I want you to just kind of tell everybody what exactly is happening with you.
Well, to make the whole story pretty short, I am a property owner. I purchased a property a couple of years back, and I had some issues with foreclosure. And in the panic of it all, I reached out for help. And I was introduced to some people who were supposed to help me do a short sale. Not knowing, I was called to sign some documents and stuff to get access to the bank, and unknowing to me, I had signed documents giving them the deed to my property, not knowing that.
You didn't know that you had signed away your deed?
No. I thought it.
Right. That is what they call deed theft. They told you something else, but as it turns out, they were really tricking you into signing away your deed.
And now the
problem with that was that they then have the deed, but you still have the mortgage, is that right?
Yes, unfortunately. Yes, a very large mortgage, over $1 million, and it's growing in interest every day.
Now let's kind of walk through what that means. They have the deed, you are still paying the mortgage.
Yes, I have the mortgage, and they have the property rented out, and they collect in rent, and not paying a mortgage, not paying anything actually, insurance, anything on the property, just pretty much milking it, and yeah.
But did they pay you for the property?
No, of course not. No, they did not one dime.
So you never got paid for the property. What did you think you were signing?
I understood that I was going to be doing a short sale because I thought I didn't have no options. So, of course, when most people are in foreclosure, they just panic. So I was told that I have two options, going to foreclosure or I can do a short sale, which is, of course, the bank would negotiate and get the property off my name. So I thought I was signing a document giving them access to my bank so they can communicate to speak about the short sale.
And so, but what happened? You never received any money, and there never was an actual sale.
There was not a sale. It was not supposed to be a sale. It was to do a short sale down the road, but they never actually follow up on that. They just took the deed of the property and left me with the mortgage. Usually, a short sale, the mortgage is transferred, and the bank negotiates whatever. The differences, and the person purchases the property, but they don't have a mortgage. The mortgage is still in my name.
The mortgage is in your name. You're paying the mortgage. The people who have the deed are collecting rents from the tenants in the building.
Yeah, it has totally destroyed my credit, and it has been really frustrating because I've been having to go to court, spending a lot of money in court fees and lawyers to fight them, and they're fighting me.
So what? When you fight them, what is that like? What are you saying? What are you doing?
Well, the process, unfortunately, for this is a very long and tedious process, which they bank on that most people would give up. So So these guys would take you through a long litigation, what they call a litigation, where there's a lot of motions and back and forth, and they keep fighting, and they go back. It's been years. I've been doing this since 2012, and the court system just is really slow, mm-hmm. and so that's what it is. There's a lot of paperwork pretty much before it can even go before a judge, and they're just buying time because that's how they get to move the property and take the money. Because they don't care about the property. They just care about the money.
Mm-hmm.
So the longer the process is for them, which they know, and then most people would give up because it's a lot. It's very expensive to lawyers to do litigation.
And so you're going to court. They don't show up in court anymore to even respond to you.
Well, they're showing up, but they're not falling by the rules. So if the judge say they have to put money in escrow, they're not doing that. If the judge say right now they're supposed to go and do a deposition where they sit and they're not showing up. So they just keep putting it off. And then when they go and they didn't show up, and then we have to file another motion. And every time I have to pay my lawyer to try. So they just keep, you know, this back and forth thing, mm-hmm. where they know how they could prolong it for as long as they can until the system decides, well, because there's lawyers, and, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, it's not black and white. Mm-hmm. It's really not that easy. Yeah, it's very exhausting. And most people, I'm sure, they can't afford it. Most people who are already in foreclosure, it's financially draining. It's been financially and mentally and emotionally exhausting for me. But because I'm just not that kind of person to give up, and I think mm-hmm. they need to learn, you know, that this is, you know, so I'm standing up for all the people who can't stand themselves.
Indeed. Let me just ask you this. We were going to run out of time. Let me just, when you go to court, we're not clear how the court has not just ruled in your favor, have not just pointed out that this was an example of deed theft. So what does the court, I don't understand how the court is not giving you back the deed or giving them the mortgage or It sounds like it's not being resolved at all when you go back and forth to court. You wind up in the same position.
Well, because with the court system, once you sign a document, it, in their eyes, it's pretty black and white. So because I signed on a dotted line, I have to prove now that I did not know. And because of that, there's also so many different parts. Like they sold the property to another entity. They transferred the deed. So I had to go after another company. They keep transferring the deed. So it's a lot. I mean, it would take us a while to explain it. It's a very long, tedious, and mm-hmm. these people transfer the deeds over. So when you think you're fighting this company, you're going after another one now. So it's a long process. And the court doesn't even understand. They thought, actually, the judge said recently she didn't know that someone... The loan is not transferred with the deed. I said, no, apparently it's not. You can have a deed and not have a loan, which is crazy.
Mm-hmm. So that is part of our concern, people not being able
exactly.
to respond
exactly.
to that.
Exactly. So,
I appreciate you being with us. We're going to continue to talk with you. I want to get you to come back. We're coming back next week. We're going to be able to spend additional time with this story. But I wanted people to hear what it is that you were going through. Just to be clear, you were a target. You were a victim of what is now called deed theft.
Yeah.
And they literally stole your deed through misinformation, misdirection. And I understand that that is illegal. There's a new bill, a deed theft bill, that was co-authored by Senator Velmanette Montgomery. But there's also just the penal code that says that a certain kind of behavior is illegal. And part of that is when people are misled into a program or into a trick, a trap, thought that they were doing one thing. And actually, they were being conned into doing something else. But the problem we have is that the court is not moving. You stay right where you are. They transfer to another company. You're coming up to them. When you're just about to get them, they transfer to another company.
Yeah.
And the court makes you start over. There's something wrong with that whole process. Keep listening, all right? Thank you for sharing your experience. Keep listening. And I want to get you to come back. Maybe you can come back next week, and we'll talk a little bit further.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you, sir. I will. Yeah.
All right, Lisa Abbott, thank you very much for being with us. I'm Bob Law. It is 11:24 on a Saturday morning in the city. We're going to continue the conversation with attorney Yolanda Nicholson. She joins us in a minute. Stay with me. Let me just share this information with you that comes from an organization that has been dealing with this foreclosure issue and these problems for some time. The 2019 foreclosure epidemic targeted to destabilize black and brown communities, and the foreclosure crisis is far from over. In the past 10 years, hundreds of thousands of foreclosure actions were commenced in New York State. In 2017, 167,848 pre-foreclosure notices were sent to homeowners across the state. Black and brown communities, once targeted for subprime and predatory lending, are today's hotbeds for gentrification through foreclosure judgments and actions. So I want you to understand there's a whole background for this. Black ownership decreased significantly by 50% in Brooklyn since 2012. The New Economy Project recently reported that in 2018, there were thousands of New Yorkers of color continued to bear the brunt of the subprime lending crisis. Residents of New York City neighborhoods of color received pre-foreclosure notices more than twice as often as residents of other neighborhoods. It is the way that it is being characterized in terms of what is happening right now. I was looking for something else. But at any rate, as we are saying, that it is targeting black folk. Thousands of New Yorkers of color, those New Yorkers of color, the color happens to be black, continue to bear the brunt of the subprime lending crisis. In the past decades, hundreds of thousands of homeowners in black and brown communities from Buffalo to Brooklyn, from Erie County to Suffolk County, and the article, the series in Newsday bears that out as you move out into Suffolk County. They lost their property in foreclosure proceedings. Borrowers who qualified for loan modifications were denied unfairly, and high percentages of Wall Street investors in subprime residential mortgage-backed securities and by their big bank loan services like Wells Fargo Bank and J.P. Morgan and Chase Bank. The legislature's mandate on the courts to save homeownership whenever possible is being circumvented routinely. One of the people who is really very much aware of that, one of the people who has taken some significant steps to push back against that, is Attorney Yolanda Nicholson. Yolanda Nicholson joins us. She's a graduate of Columbia University Law School. In 2003, she was as an executive on loan from J.P. Morgan. She began working with Bed-Stuy Restoration, and she served as Restoration's executive vice president and general counsel. And then in 2006, she returned to Wall Street as a senior attorney in the financial products group at Clifford Chance. She also represented Standard & Poor's on complex collateralized loan obligations. And in 2010, she began a private legal practice specializing in foreclosure prevention. And recently, she pioneered the formation of the New York State Foreclosure Defense Bar, which is where some of this information that we are quoting is coming from. Attorney Nicholson, welcome to From the Street with Bob Law. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you. Good morning. It's an honor and a privilege to be with you this morning, and thank you so much for bringing forward this crisis and what we call an epidemic now, bringing it to the fore.
Yep. Now, there's a couple of things that I wanted you to just help people understand. The headline says, court rules against city, millions of dollars of wealth restored. And that is where, and I believe that was a case that you were handling, where the...
Is this a TPT?
Yes.
So I actually consulted on those cases in terms of reversing the initial cases. TPT stands for third-party transfer, and in fall of 2018, it came to the community's attention that our city government was in fact involved in a program. Everything is happening in the shadows, right? So in the shadows, using a very unusual proceeding that's not in line with due process was taking private property for very de minimis taxes, and a number of the property owners moved to have the judgments vacated while we crafted what is now pending, a federal lawsuit. We've gone into federal court to ask the court to give us class certification to try to address the hundreds, if not thousands, I think it's going to, of properties taken through this process since 1996 when the law was passed.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the city council did its own review of the proceeding and actually found that the city's activities were more egregious. So in addition to having the onslaught of bank foreclosures and a court that has taken a hands-off to due process or the laws that are in place to save home ownership, we now found out that our very own city government mm-hmm. has layered on in black and brown communities, and I'm with you. Because, you know, it's nice, it is true that it's black and brown communities, but it's also true that I think that this is because it's African-American homeowners,
mm-hmm.
African-Americans who acquired home ownership with no help from anyone during Jim Crow and after the Civil Rights Movement, in spite of redlining, in spite of predatory lending, and someone woke up and said, wow, we've got a lot of black homeowners from Maine to California. We got to get them out of this position. They can't be given the pursuit of happiness. They can't be given that power en masse.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a massive movement that I think has a lot of intentionality to make sure that we reduce those numbers. And we've seen it. You quoted it. Dr. Flatow at Medgar Evers did the study on the census data. We're down 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all being done. You know, it's wonderful that you had that young lady. Lisa Abbott's case is exemplary because the courts are the place where what's called deed theft,
mm-hmm.
I like to call it equity theft and home ownership theft, because you when you steal that, you steal generations of being in place, having a place to live, having a right to be in this city, and having something to pass on. And the courts are looking the other way and have become a commodities trading market for illegal foreclosures and auctions mm. for the investor market.
And using city agencies, the city is very much involved in this. So it appears to us thus far, we have a real concern for, as the Councilman Carnegie pointed out at the top of the discussion here, we have a real concern for the behavior of HPD and the people who work there, who operate within the law. But when they say they operate within the law, those are policies that are written just as you and he have indicated. Those policies are written in order to be able to unjustly take property away. It is not uncommon in New York City, in New York State. Eric Adams and I can testify to that. Some years ago, we attempted to get on the ballot to run for Congress. And you find out when they disqualify your petitions that you can be disqualified for using two different color inks on the same page. You know,
right.
You can be disqualified that somebody signed my petition who grew up in church, is an evangelist known in her community as such. Everything on her line was correct. Her name, her address, her election district, everything was correct. But she said she was Evangelist Mary Johnson. And they said, because she used the word evangelist, that her invalidated her signature. Everything was correct, but they invalidated the signature, and that was all part of the policy. People can hide behind that, but now with this ruling, I'm reading here that Kings County Supreme Court Judge Mark Partnow ruled that the city of New York violated the U.S. Constitution in the seizure of 6 Central Brooklyn properties and ordered the city to give them back to their owners. Do you know what the judge was pointing to in terms of it being a violation of the U.S. Constitution?
Well, we like to think that the judge read our complaint because the decision came out 2 weeks after we filed a complaint in federal court.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've alleged is that the method of taking and the law that the city law that was utilized for the taking has a unequal treatment impact.
Mm-hmm.
So it violates the 14th Amendment. It's also violative of the Due Process Clause of both the U.S. Constitution and the New York Constitution, meaning that you can't just take someone's property without due process of law, proper notice, proper judicial proceeding, and it's also discriminatory. Now, that's a whole bunch of legalese. If you give me an opportunity, I'll just
sure.
put it very simply.
Yes.
You know, from the beginning of this country, from the beginning of this federal country and this federal government, the thing that was most sacrosanct for everyone else but for people of African descent was the ownership of property. It is the part of the Constitution that goes to pursuit of happiness. But when it comes to applying the laws that were fought for in the Revolutionary War to give private citizens that protection, to this day, our governments, our city government, HPD, and our judicial courts seem to be having a really, really difficult time being objective and being judicious and being with integrity to apply those law in the same way because it's black and brown homeowners.
Mm-hmm.
Black and brown homeowners are viewed as deadbeats. They're treated, they're profiled as though they weren't supposed to be in a mortgage, they can't afford to be in a mortgage, they can't keep their properties up, they don't know how to care for their properties, and thus the big brother government from HPD, who's now headed up by a sister,
mm-hmm.
is saying, well, we can take these properties. So they've put in place, when you have a government and a judicial process that takes something that's improper and blesses it with the stroke of a pen, it's like the old money laundering.
Absolutely.
So now you have the court, is like in Ms. Abbott's case, someone came and lured her into an illegal process, had her sign a document, thinking that they were going to be working on a mod for her. Then they got a deed, and then they put mortgages upon it. And the court is going to say, well, she signed it, and they're going to get a judgment. And that whole dirty process is now being cleaned up so that it now becomes legal. It now becomes proper for them to eventually move to evict her. So this is what's happening
mm-hmm.
across the board to black and brown families.
And when the developers and the schemers and the city agencies engage in this immoral conduct, they are encouraged to continue to do so by the court. By always
facilitated is the word I would use. Facilitated.
Okay. And they are always willing to do it because they know that they are going to be protected. They know that the court.
Right.
And
right.
See, and part of my concern is that it's happening under the nose of black elected officials, you know, particularly members of the city council, I mean, who won't even talk to us. Lori Cumbo, who's in Fort Greene in the district where this is happening, we can't even get her on the phone, even though she's agreed to be on the call. Once we all get on the call, she doesn't show up. Adrian Adams and Danique Miller out in Queens, I've got a brother going out there. We're trying to talk to them. Can't get them on the phone. I wonder, who do they work for? Because they certainly don't appear to work for their constituents. I want to read something for you, get your reaction. Then I want people to hear what your organization, the New York State Foreclosure Defense Bar, has kind of summed up that makes what's happening really very clear. But this is a letter that's a property owner sent to HPD. And the property owner said that the visit by your HPD inspector to this place, to this address, neglected to address a minor under 16 living in a unit in SRO. It is impossible to be in unit and not see the child and evidence of a child. She's trying to get these people who are squatters out of the building and,
mm-hmm.
and can't get them out of the building. It says your program is proving to unfairly be identifying small black female homeowners and provide easy access for developers to profit. The corrections are outside the range of necessity. Cooking facilities are not required in an SRO, so installing gas is not required. Now, she had initially argued that, but I don't collect rent from these people. I don't know these people. You know, when I took over this building, these squatters were already there, and
mm-hmm.
I can't get them out. Now they are suing me for not providing heat and hot water and electricity in, and they shouldn't be in this building at all. She says pointing of bricks is unnecessary and only benefits the future developers. If your attempt to bankrupt current homeowners were to succeed, the new electric and new waste pipes is clearly a ploy to create huge amount of debt on a mortgage-free property. Who determines the entire waste pipes are effective, or is it simply an added value for developers waiting in the wings? There's no legal occupants living in the building. Your failure to address this fact at the outset of selecting my home for this questionable enforcement act is problematic. And it raises some questions about where do these laws come from? Who wrote the law that your department can tell the homeowner what color paint to put on the wall and the ceilings? And then when you look at the actual violation itself, let's look at an actual violation. Some of the things that are here says replace with new or broken or defective air valve at radiator at north wall. Replace with new the broken or defective turnoff valve at radiator in north wall. Talking about the same radiator, but it comes up as two different violations. So there's two different fines. Replace new, and a lot about replace new and broken defective radiators. But there's one that says that you have to change the color of the paint on the ceiling so that the paint on the ceiling is consistent with the paint on the wall. But it doesn't say change the paint because it has lead in it. It says just that the color is wrong and there's a fine if you don't do it. But here's what's kind of interesting. Now, and this is, at this point, is still legal. See, there are lead-based paint violations. They must be corrected according to Title 28. And so that makes sense. But they say that if the inspector says that surface may contain lead-based paint, the area affected by a non-lead violation includes a painted surface, unless XRF testing establishes that the paint on the surface does not contain lead, the law presumes that the paint is lead-based. Now, the law and HPD doesn't test it to see. What they say to the property owner is that you have to get it tested and then bring back the results of the test, and that there's a guide to local law. One is a book called The Guide to Local Law 1. Of 2004 work practices, which describes the work practices and worker training required to make repairs safely. So you need to go get that book and find out how it is that this test must be conducted and get that done, and then come back and prove that the paint was not lead-based, that they can come in and just assume that the paint is lead-based without any kind of a test at all on the part of HPD to determine if, in fact, there's lead in the paint. And I'm looking at one of the violations that says administrative code, quotes the code, and it says, paint with light-colored paint to the satisfaction of this department at ceiling in the kitchen. Paint with light-colored paint to the satisfaction of this department, the ceiling in the kitchen. What kind of policy is that?
Right. Well, you know, this sounds, there's so much there to unpack, and I just want to say before I actually was listening intently and would come to the specifics, but, you know, the large problem was the mortgage, the national and the mortgage foreclosures, and the laws and the electeds that are charged to address this is actually at the state level. Mm-hmm. And we've been calling for a moratorium on foreclosures at the city level with respect to the third-party transfer and the sort of things that you've been describing in that example. At the hearing, the HPD commission admitted that they focused on the areas where there were high mortgage foreclosures to do the TPT program. Coming to the description, this is what happened. You've got DOB, Department of Buildings, and HPD inspectors running around and charging homeowners for repairs and inspections and adding it to their tax bills, mm-hmm, for things that are either non-existent, we found, and the city council has found, or things that can't be complied with. You know, it's like the old Jim Crow law. Mm-hmm. Show up if you want to vote, but show us a driver's license in Spanish. You know right. what I'm saying?
How,
or show us
how many bubbles. How many bubbles
in
the bar
on
soap?
The wall. Right.
They, that was one of the tests with those voting rights laws. How many bubbles in a bar?
And these
soap?
Are the same sort of things. So not only can this property owner probably not comply if even they're aware, then the inspector puts a charge or puts a subpoena, and then there's a judgment, and then there's a charge on their tax bill, and then the city designates it distressed, and the findings have shown that even within their own distress law, the law says that you can't take a property in distress or designate it as distress unless there are tax liens that are 15% or greater than the market value of the property, and there are, you know, health and hazard violations, I'm just going to summarize, mm-hmm. in the amount of thousands of dollars. Well, we've yet to find one of the buildings that was taken and given off to their private developer friends. They, you know, they're all under the banner of nonprofits. So add to those who are participating in the taking of our community, a lot of these nonprofits who are led by people looking like us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they have bad intention. I think they've misguided. I think that somehow we have gotten ourselves in this bandwagon that when it comes to black and brown people, that self-determination is still not something that they can handle, which is a old slave racist thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a city government led by a mayor who said he was going to stop the tale of two cities with commissioners and a city council, housing committees and city planning looking to the city council with black and brown leaders who cannot say stop it, put a halt, because what would happen with that building you described, there's probably going to be some sort of building violation fee that is in the thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars eventually. And eventually, if it's not stopped, the city is going to take it in TPT, conclude that the owner could not take care of their own building because they're setting standards that are beyond the realistic or required. Like, how could you decide or know what kind of paint they're talking about for your ceiling? Or why don't you have the right to choose how you want to paint your house?
Mm-hmm.
Or whether you know what I mean? So we are back in a time, and I think people need to really get, especially homeowners like Ms. Abbott. There are so many of them out there that black and brown families have no place to go. The courts have said, we are not here for you. We have more black and brown judges on the bench.
It means
they
very
don't
little.
Even handle the cases.
It means very little, absolutely. And we hear, like with black and elected officials, like Councilman Perkins in Harlem, who actually said that there are black people who just don't deserve to own property. And,
yes.
And he went on to say there are black people who are just not meant to own property. It means that you were not born to be a property owner. See what?
Right.
And part of the problem is allowing council people like that to remain in office. That is a part of what part
well,
of
that
our concern.
Thinking is pervasive
everywhere
at the appellate levels of the court.
Yep.
And so we have the best laws in New York State. You take Ms. Abbott's case. The court is charged by the legislature to look at a family, see if there are means for them to get a loan modification. You know, under the prior President Obama's administration, he said he was going to save 4 million homes with loan modifications, right? Well, the study showed in 2015 that 4 million families were denied unfairly and or unfoundedly, and if you bury down in the numbers, it's black and brown families here in Brooklyn. So that thinking is why, you know, I welcome the opportunity to speak out,
mm-hmm.
because I think our homeowners, our community, you know, people are just vulnerable and they have nowhere to turn.
Absolutely.
Because the investors and the private equity guys are running around funding campaigns, buying property, imposing buildings. I was in East Flatbush and Flatbush on Thursday. There were these 5 and 6 family buildings or units going up on one family lots, encroaching on one family buildings. And it's all okay because New York City laws encourage this, allow it, and we have an investor climate that's controlling the courthouse.
Let me just do this. We're running out of time. But I got to get. We're going to continue this conversation next week. I got to get you to come back and help us close out on all of this. We've been talking to attorney Yolanda Nicholson, and who has helped found one of the founders of the what is the name of your organization?
New York State Foreclosure Defense Bar.
I want to sum up some of the things that they have said that kind of sum all of this up. But there's a lot more that we have to talk about and make clear. And we're going to have an additional hour next week in order to be able to take this even further. But for now, just for now, Attorney Nicholson, thank you so much for spending this time with us and bringing this information. You were really great, made a lot of things really clear. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I hope I was helpful. Sometimes, you know, lawyers could get in the weeds, so
no,
I hope I
great.
Didn't.
You were great. You were great. I got to get you to come back next week. Thank you so much.
I'll be happy to, and I'll be honored.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Everybody enjoy their Saturday.
Keep in mind, this kind of a conversation only happens here. This kind of a conversation and this kind of investigative reporting and pursuing these issues only happens here, only happens with people like me, activists who are on the air. And so it is important that you help us stay here. I need you to send some money to WBAI. And when you send the money to WBAI, tell them that you did it in response to Bob Law. The station needs to know that. They need to know. They want to know which programs are generating money. Even though it is intended to give voice to the community, now we're being told that in order to give voice to the community, some of these shows are going to have to pay to be able to do that. Here's the number that you should call if you can make a pledge right now, whatever amount you can. See how important these shows are. See how important these conversations are. I need you to call right now, 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. If you can call, make a pledge, tell them that Bob Law sent you. That'll be helpful. One of the things that the New York State Foreclosure Defense Bar has pointed out is that the high rate of mortgage home loans and private market by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and HUD to cash-rich head fund or individual investors, plus the low rate of loan modification approvals to qualified borrowers between 2009 and 2015 under the federal government's HAMP program, plus the influence of New York State courts by foreclosing plaintiffs and their attorneys to set aside or disregard legislative protection to save home ownership, have resulted in an accelerated foreclosure crisis in New York City communities of color, in Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx. Low rates of loan modification, high rates of foreclosure judgment and auctions, legal and illegal, increased numbers of cash sales in state courts, improper evictions in city courts, moral hazards equals moral hazards on families of color. There's a lot. The point is that this is structured, it is deliberate, and we've got to take some steps to do something about it, and we can. We're going to do that. I need you to come back with me next week before we run out of time. Alina is here, and you've got some information about a program that you are engaged in Brooklyn.
Yes. So I am a member and a social media director for a nonprofit organization in Brownsville called Empowering Youth Towards Excellence, aka like EYTE. So this holiday season, the founder, Mr. Javon Johnson, and the EYTE Dream Team do a turkey drive. So they go around the community and they give turkeys to family needs, like teachers and staff at local schools, seniors in the community. They also do a toy drive in which Mr. Johnson, the EYTE Dream Team, and CUNY students like myself go around and donate toys to local schools. And CUNY students also stop by local elementary schools and middle schools to talk about college experiences and stuff like that. So if you want to support the efforts and work of EYTE, make sure to follow EYTE on Instagram at EYTEINC or donate to their GoFundMe page.
Is that right?
Yes.
She did a good job with that, didn't she? Good to have you with us. And Javon is out there in Brownsville giving away turkeys.
Yes.
Good. And if you want to see Alina live in person, she'll be there.
So yes, I will. I'll be in the community helping out giving out turkeys and
she'll
toys.
She'll be giving out turkeys. So go up and ask which one of y'all is Alina. We'll be back next week as we continue, and we'll take this further. We're looking at how we sum it all up and the kind of things that we can do to really make a difference. Don't forget, if you can make a donation on any level at all, call 516-620-3602. We need a platform to keep this kind of investigative journalism alive, particularly coming from the black community. I'm Bob Law. Glad to have you with us. I remember when the music used to lift your spirits. I remember when there was a music that you could feel it as you listened to the music. I just remember when the music made a positive difference in our lives.
My name is Michael G. Haskins. WBAI is listener-supported, commercial-free, resistance radio, challenging norms and defying them. Let's break down what that means. It means that no clandestine corporate entity tells me how to do my show. You better believe that. It means that you, the listener, and the diverse WBAI community have a voice which reverberates across the tri-state area. You drive this station, so fuel us. Donate by visiting give2wbai.org or pledge right now from your smartphone by texting the letters WBAI to 41444. And thank you for your support.
Hello, I'm David Rothenberg, and I'm the oldest person of any room I enter, unless Malachi McCord is already plopped down in the room. So the two of us are getting together to have a conversation. And if you want to eavesdrop on it, and we'll be departing some wisdom, it'll cost you $25. But all the money's going to this cockamamie station, WBAI, which you might have heard could use a dollar or two. Conversation with Malachi and David will be at the Commons, the performance space below WBAI's Crystal Studios at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. The gathering will be on Sunday, December 8th at 2 o'clock. For ticket reservations, email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Leave your phone number and I'll call you back. So once again, it's Sunday, December 8th. At 2 o'clock, 388 Atlantic Avenue, and you can email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com.
Hi, this is David Amram. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 on your FM dial, and keep on listening.
Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Before you continue on with your day, I'd like to ask you to visit the website at WBAI.org and consider becoming a BAI buddy. For as little as $10 a month, you can help the station and make a recurring donation on behalf of this program. As a BAI buddy, you receive a WBAI membership card, as well as very nice discounts at area museums and various local facilities, and selected WBAI-supported events. And all donate a free CD, no charge to the station. It's a safe, secure, and easy way for you to support this commercial-free, listener-sponsored radio station